we are satisfied with that. We think it is indicative of continued success and progress.
The Alaska Gas Line Project begins another phase. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Alaska VA struggles to recruit doctors for the Mat-Su Valley.
And especially now with the VA not paying incentive compensations to keep people, you know, at the end of each cycle.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The partnership to build a natural gas megaproject has initiated the environmental review process. BP, Exxon, ConocoPhillips, TransCanada, and the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation submitted paperwork to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on Friday, notifying the agency that they plan to finish collecting safety and environmental data on the project by 2016. They're aiming for federal permitting to be completed by 2018, with construction to begin shortly after. The company's described the pre-filing as a major milestone in the development of a liquefied natural gas export project that could cost upwards of $45 billion. Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash agrees this is a good early step for getting North Slope gas to market.
The fact that the project has achieved certain steps to this date, they are largely on time, on budget. We are satisfied with that. We think it is indicative of continued success and progress, but there are still many, many more steps to go.
The Alaska LNG project would require an 800-mile pipeline extending from the North Slope to Nikiski, and it would be capable of transmitting nearly 3 billion cubic feet of gas per day. While some of that gas could be utilized by Alaska consumers, the partnership plans to market most of the gas to Asia. To that end, the state is currently courting nations along the Pacific Rim. Balash is currently in Tokyo, where he signed off on an agreement with the nation's Ministry of Commerce to exchange information related to a gas line. He says it shows Japan's government is taking the project seriously.
This project and the state of Alaska are credible.
Balash will travel to China and South Korea next, but is not expecting any immediate agreements to come out of those visits. Larry Pursley is the federal coordinator for Alaska. He says the agreement with Japan is a positive development. But even so, Pursley says, we've been here before with natural gas projects in Alaska. BP and ConocoPhillips entered pre-file process with their Denali pipeline proposal in 2008, before abandoning it 3 years and more than $100 million later. Exxon and TransCanada went through a similar and even more costly effort while supported by the Palin-era Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. The U.S. House today passed a bill to allow Alaska natives to sell handicrafts that include the feathers of migratory birds. Alaska Congressman Don Young said on the House floor, the Migratory Bird Act already allows Alaska natives to harvest migratory birds.
What we have today is a bizarre policy that allows Alaska natives to hunt, kill, consume, and also use non-edible parts and handicraft items, but prohibits them from selling these handicrafts.
Federal authorities haven't always enforced the law, but 2 years ago pursued a case against a Tlingit carver from Juneau. Archie Cavanaugh agreed to pay a $2,000 fine after he was caught trying to sell two wood headpieces online that included flicker and raven feathers. The bill passed the House by voice vote. Senator Lisa Murkowski sponsored a similar bill that's pending in the Senate. The Wasilla Veterans Affairs Clinic is without a doctor, and now one nurse practitioner is handling the patient caseload. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Verdi Bowen, director of the state's Office of Veterans Affairs, says the Wasilla Clinic's doctors who worked under contract this summer have decided not to renew. The clinic is supposed to have two doctors on staff at all times, but the Wasilla Clinic has used one doctor and a nurse practitioner, while a third temporary doctor rotates in and out. Now, only the nurse practitioner remains to handle the 1,000 cases that the clinic handles in a year. Bowen says the patients are in no danger of not getting care, however, thanks to agreements the VA has with South Central Foundation and Providence Hospital for their clinics in Wasilla.
South Central Foundation is receiving up to 700 patients from that clinic. And we also have another contract with Providence Care, which is also seeing patients as well. And so what we have done is throughout the community of Wasilla, we've diversified the patients. And those that live closer to the Anchorage side, say, for instance, like Peters Creek or Chugiak, is given the opportunity to come into Anchorage and be treated at that larger facility.
The Wasilla nurse practitioner works under the supervision of the VA doctor in Anchorage. Bowen says that despite the shortage of staff, the Wasilla clinic is operating.
We have a few people in that are still housed out of the clinic in Wasilla that's being treated by the nurse practitioner there. And so the veterans are still receiving their care. There's still no, you know, waiting list for those veterans to receive their health care.
Right now, the Wasilla Clinic has openings for two doctors, but Bowen says it is difficult for the VA to attract new doctors because of pay concerns.
The VA is locked in with the amount of funds that they can pay, and I really don't know what that is per doctor. And especially now with the VA not paying incentive compensations to keep people, you know, at the end of each cycle, then that's causing a negative factor in retaining those doctors in those locations.
Cynthia Joe, chief of staff for the Alaska VA healthcare system, said that the VA is offering what it is allowed to offer for salaries. That level is capped at $195,000 annually. Bowen says that often the Alaska lifestyle does not appeal to VA doctors who come here to work from the lower 48. He says the shortage of doctors is not simply a VA problem, that it is symptomatic of a problem in clinics nationwide because fewer students are graduating from medical colleges. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, kids weigh in on whether sixth grade should be elementary or middle school.
I think that sixth grade is a good time to move to middle school because by fifth grade, I think the elementary schoolers are done of walking in lines and no lockers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at Alaska.bp.com.
U.S. Senate challenger Dan Sullivan has won a rare endorsement from the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. Rebecca Logan, the Trades Association general manager, says the board made the decision last week.
It's the first time in about 20 years that the organization has endorsed a political candidate. We typically don't do that. But because we feel that the outcome of this election has such a huge impact on resource development in the state of Alaska, we felt it was important to do so.
Logan says the board likes Sullivan's experience fighting for resource development. It also hopes his election will put the Senate in Republican control, which would elevate Senator Lisa Murkowski to important leadership roles. The alliance represents service companies in the oil, gas, and mining industries. Incumbent Senator Mark Begich disappointed the group by backing the EPA's move to block development of the Pebble Mine near Bristol Bay. Meanwhile, Begich continues to rack up endorsements from fishing trade associations. The Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association announced their support of him last week, praising his grasp of complex fisheries issues. Begich also has the endorsements from the Bering Sea Crabbers and United Fishermen of Alaska. The National Park Service published a proposal in the National Register last week that would permanently prohibit some sport hunting practices in Alaska's 10 national preserves. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the Park Service has sparred with the state for years over hunting in national preserves.
The National Park Service wants to permanently prohibit three predator hunting practices in all 10 of Alaska's national preserves. John Quinley is the spokesperson for the National Park Service in Alaska. He says those practices were historically illegal in the state until recently.
For instance, harvesting brown bears over black bear bait stations has historically been illegal. That changed a while back under state regulations, and when it did, we put in place temporary restrictions so that that practice would not occur in national preserves. We are moving to make that a permanent change rather than going back every year and proposing a temporary change.
The Park Service's proposal would also permanently prohibit sport hunting for wolves and coyotes in early summer. The use of artificial light to take black bear sows and cubs at dens would also become illegal in Alaska's national preserves. For at least the last 4 years, those practices have been temporarily restricted by the Park Service.
As the Board of Game over the last 8 to 10 years has increasingly liberalized predator hunting rules on national preserves, we have become increasingly vocal.
Quinley says state laws aren't in keeping with the Park Service's federal mandate to maintain natural ecosystems and wildlife populations therein.
Our opposition to their wildlife management methods is only on national preserves. How the state of Alaska manages other lands is up to the state of Alaska.
But Board of Game Commissioner Ted Spranker says he thinks the Park Service just doesn't understand how the state manages wildlife.
Well, the purpose of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is very clear, that they're mandated to maintain healthy populations, and if they're harvested, to harvest at some level that sustains the populations. And, you know, one of the things that's always said, and it's very true, if they're hunted, they're healthy.
In a press release, the Park Service argues the state is, quote, reducing native predators for the purpose of increasing numbers of harvested species, unquote. Spraker says that's not the case.
This has nothing to do with predator control. The reason the board implemented these hunting opportunities is just that. These populations are healthy. Predator numbers are healthy, at least in all the cases we've been presented, if not abundant. And what the board did is we just increased hunting opportunity. That is for the baiting of brown bears and the longer seasons for wolves and coyotes.
This past spring, the Department of Natural Resources Executive Director for the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Lands sent a letter to the Park Service as part of a required public process. "We do not support the adoption of these temporary restrictions," writes Stanley Part, "nor will we support permanent regulation preempting state general hunting regulations." The letter goes on to say the state expected the National Park Service to, quote, "begin the process of preparing permanent regulations," unquote.
No, we knew it was coming.
Ted Spraker says the Board of Game will likely submit comments on the most recent proposal published in the Federal Register. The public comment period opens in October. But Spraker also calls the process a waste of time.
Absolutely. When they're saying that they've been doing this for 4 years in a row and now they're going to make it permanent, but they're going to go through a public process to see if they're doing the right thing, it is a waste of the public time. It's a waste of taxpayers' dollars for these guys to do it. And I hate to see people giving them a free pass. I mean, people should go and testify, but don't expect that they're going to turn around and allow baiting or allow flashlights or allow the taking of wolves in May.
John Quinley says the Park Service expects state pushback.
We do expect a spirited conversation with the state of Alaska, and we will be having formal consultation with the state of Alaska on the proposals as well.
The proposal also updates subsistence regulations and prohibits the obstruction of lawful hunting or trapping on Park Service lands. Public hearings on the proposal will take place in various communities in Alaska in October. The public comment period is open until early December. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Anchorage School District is trying to decide if sixth graders should be placed in elementary or middle school. Currently, there are some in each. District staff have been weighing the options for more than a year. They're also looking at what's best for the students academically. KSKA's Ann Hillman found out what the kids think.
Sixth grader Janera Faliga enters the deafening lunchroom at Begich Middle School and sits down with her friends.
So y'all in sixth grade?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Good.
Do you like it better than elementary school?
Yeah.
Why?
Because we get lockers.
Yeah.
Lockers are resoundingly the best thing about middle school, according to this group and many others. Faliga says she wished they had them in elementary school, too.
When we switch for classes, for reading classes in elementary, the person who's sitting in your desk might take something out of your desk. So I don't like that because they're invading your privacy.
Seventh grader Leola Atkinson agrees. She loves the privacy of middle school and the chance to meet more people. She says she survived learning to open her locker and move between classes.
I think that sixth grade is a good time to move to middle school because by fifth grade, I think the elementary schoolers are done of walking in lines and no lockers and stuff, so I think it's good.
Begich Middle School principal Brian Singleton agrees. He says middle school is developmentally more appropriate for most sixth graders.
I guess in a nutshell, they have more responsibilities to be independent, even though we support them greatly, which I think is more relevant to their developmental age at this time.
Singleton, who used to work at Government Hill Elementary, says some sixth graders are physically much larger too, making them look out of place in elementary schools. He says the transition from elementary to middle school is hard for kids who enter both in the sixth and the seventh grade.
It's the differences and the change that seem to be more significant than necessarily how they're responding to it based on their age.
A 2007 study from Duke University shows that kids who stay in elementary school for sixth grade do better academically and have fewer discipline problems. The effects last through the ninth grade. The researchers think it's because impressionable sixth graders in the middle schools were mixed together with older adolescents who were more rebellious. ASD Chief Academic Officer Michael Graham says he was surprised by the national data, but that's not the only thing the district will consider when making the decision. He says they're also conducting local research, considering the financial impacts of changing the system, and asking community members to weigh in on the questions.
Sixth graders certainly have a lot more opportunities to do some things in middle school, but there's also you're leaving behind that safe environment where there's that teacher, a couple teachers who know you well, families are well connected, those kinds of things.
Some sixth graders at Lake Otis Elementary, like Tommy Lee, say they think staying in elementary school is a mixed bag.
Yes, because we still get to go outside and all that, but no, because I feel like I'm still a kid inside elementary because I want to get to the biggest stuff.
Sixth grader Jesselyn Senny says she's not sure if she would have been ready for the responsibilities of being a school role model last year, but she likes it now.
You have a lot of responsibilities, but in a way it's more fun because you have more freedom. Like, you get sometimes a longer recess, or usually, like, you get more field trips. And people just look up to you, and that's kind of the cool thing.
The school board plans to decide the future of Anchorage's sixth graders by the end of October. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
For years, shipping safety advocates have called for better protections against oil spills in the Aleutian chain. Now, the plan for a new response system is finally finished. The Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment's draft report recommends some familiar solutions in new places, all at a cost of almost $14 million per year. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
The risk assessment started in response to a major disaster just off Unalaska's shores. 10 years ago, the bulk carrier Selendang IU ran aground near the island, killing 6 people and spilling fuel into the Bering Sea. It was the worst shipping accident in the region's history, and the risk assessment was designed to make sure it couldn't happen again. Since 2009, researchers and stakeholders have been studying everything from tugboat locations to shipping routes to weather conditions, all while marine traffic in the Aleutians continue to increase. Tim Robertson is a lead author of their new report.
I certainly wish it hadn't taken as long as it has. You know, there's been frustration, I think, from all levels that why aren't we doing more and studying less.
But they wanted to make sure they had all their bases covered before they came out with their recommendation: create a nonprofit organization to manage better monitoring systems, spill response plans, and salvage tools in the Aleutian Islands.
We think there should be one organization that essentially provides all of these services.
That group would hire contractors to run equipment like a dedicated rescue tugboat or a heavy-duty helicopter, and it would manage the cost of the whole system, about $13.6 million a year. Robertson says about half of that would come from the users themselves, the operators of the big vessels heading through places like Unimak Pass. It's the busiest channel through the Aleutians. In 2012, for example, operators would have had to pay about $13,000 for each ship they sent across. Robertson says that would be lower if they could charge every ship that used that route, but a little less than half of those vessels are only passing through on their way to and from foreign ports, and there's no way to make them chip in for a domestic response system. So Robertson says it should fall to the federal government to cover that part of the cost, about $15 million.
We think it's probably most feasible if there was a one-time appropriation instead of trying to get ongoing operational funding.
The first purchase would be an emergency towing vessel, which would be permanently stationed in the Aleutians to head off shipping mishaps. The idea has been on the table for years, but now researchers are saying it should go in Adak. It's a town of about 300 people in the western Aleutians. That recommendation came as a big surprise to Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt. She's been involved with the risk assessment from the beginning.
When we started first looking at this, we were focused on the traffic, marine traffic, that is compressed into a part of the region, primarily because, A, they're either coming or going from our port, or they're all transiting directly through Unimak Pass.
Unimak Pass is right next to Unalaska, along the popular Great Circle shipping route. As that track curves around the globe, it leads vessels through the Aleutians a second time, near Adak. And that's where they can run into trouble. There are more crossings to choose from in the area, and Adak City Manager Leighton Lockett says some are too sensitive for commercial traffic, like Bull Deer Pass. Lockett says it's an important spot for fishing and seabird habitat.
If something were to, say, happen in Bull Deer Pass, through no fault of anyone but the vessel, it could have profound impacts in a number of different industries that we're all, you know, relied upon just because someone decided to take the scenic tour.
To address that, the risk assessment wants to close down some offshore zones to shipping traffic, and it calls for expanding the vessel tracking systems that are already in place. But Lockett says that hosting the dedicated tug in Adak would give him the greatest peace of mind. The risk assessment showed that if something went wrong in the area, there probably wouldn't be another tugboat close by to assist. In Unalaska, there are tugboats working near the port year-round. But Mayor Shirley Marquardt isn't convinced that's enough. She says Unalaska started out as the risk assessment's priority. They had several residents advising the study over the years. Now Marquardt's afraid they're getting left behind.
It just seemed like the focus just kind of shifted to we're no longer trying to prevent this happening in the first place as to, well, gee, response out far west might be difficult. And, you know, I was really cognizant of that this whole way through all these years doing this, that we don't shift. If that's an important issue, then it needs to be addressed on its own.
It's concerns like that that researchers are hoping to hear before they go any further with their work. They've started taking public comment on their draft report, and they're planning to visit Unalaska soon to present it in person and explain how it'll come together to cover the entire Aleutian chain. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
As Ketchikan Shipyard continues to grow and attract contracts, questions arose last week about whether the community should continue to offer tax and utility breaks for the property. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Ketchikan Shipyard is owned by the Alaska Industrial Energy Development and Export Authority, or ADA, but it's operated by Vigor, a Pacific Northwest company that owns shipyards in several states. Vigor bought the operating rights a few years ago, and the Vigor Alaska operation is very likely to get a lucrative contract to build two new ferries for the state of Alaska. With that in mind, does the shipyard still need financial support from the community? That's the question asked at two recent events, a Ketchikan Borough Assembly meeting and the regular Chamber of Commerce lunch. Here's Borough Assembly Member Agnes Moran, who says the community should look into developing an exit strategy.
We now have a very large company running that shipyard that essentially has a monopoly on the West Coast. It recently bought a shipyard. It recently bought an ironworks. And I think when you're looking at $1.5 million of a subsidy every year, coupled with the fact that we have, you know, the city's looking at bonding for infrastructure projects.
The subsidies Moran referenced are through local property tax breaks from the city and borough and a deal on electricity through the city-owned Ketchikan Public Utilities. Assemblymember Bill Rotecki agreed with Moran that the discussion should take place.
If we're subsidizing, that is the local municipalities and their taxpayers are subsidizing them substantially, I think it shouldn't just be forgotten. It should be looked at and evaluated, and I agree with that wholeheartedly.
During the Chamber of Commerce lunch, candidates for Borough Assembly were there for a candidate forum. An audience member asked what they thought about maintaining or eliminating Vigor's tax and utility breaks. Borough Mayor candidate David Landis says a conversation needs to happen.
Obviously, the shipyard is a cornerstone of the business in this community, and it's vital to keep it here. That being said, you don't want to give everything away.
Incumbent Assemblymember Mike Painter, who's running for re-election, agrees that the issue needs to be revisited. Incumbent Glenn Thompson, also seeking re-election, says local subsidies should go away when the shipyard is self-sustaining.
I think last year, Doug could correct me, but I think there was about $2.5 million of profit. Again, the city and the borough probably subsidized about $1.5 million of that, but even if you took that subsidy away, they still would have made a profit.
Assembly candidate John Harrington suggested that the state exempt the shipyard from paying property taxes, which the state does for an ADA property further north. Vigor Alaska's Director of Shipyard Development, Doug Ward, attended the Chamber of Commerce luncheon. He said he felt the candidate's answers were reasonable, and he's willing to have the discussion.
We're still operating a very complex manufacturing activity in a region and in a state that lacks the basic industries that go along with supporting these kinds of complex projects. So I think maybe the question gets to how much employment do we want to create through that shipyard investment.
Ward says the employment projections are 300 to 350 workers once all the facility infrastructure is in place. He noted that the agreements with the city and borough include a profit-sharing component. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Ellen Locke here in Wasilla, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Hedge is our web producer, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson project, proving energy lives here. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.